I'm wondering if you can count to 34.
By 16s?
Yes, every 16. So the thing is, if you can count 16, to 32.
32.
32 plus
falafels. Okay, got it.
Yeah. If you can count to 34, then you get the holy moly guacamole indictment count.
Is that right?
Yes.
One for each falafel in Manhattan.
Right, but the falafels weren't exactly priced correctly, you know? It was like they were $800,000 per ball. And, you know, in the real estate business, when duty calls, we got balls.
All right, well, 16. This would be actually number 16. Did you realize that?
This is
our 16th. And between 15 and 16, here's the deal. If you take a year and a half break,
you have 34.
Oh, boy. I mean, so COVID happened and we started podcasting. And that was like the podcast. It was such a great thing to do. I think a lot of people, I think we were part of a wave of people that started podcasting in the COVID era. I mean, there are so many podcasts now. Have you looked at all of that? I mean, there is so much. It's kind of amazing. I mean, I think it's like a, you know, golden era, I mean, of podcasting. There was not an era before, but this recent era, but it's really exploded with COVID. I'm amazed by the fact that
it exploded with COVID. Is that what you just said? I'm trying to be lyrical. I'm not really dealing with content on this particular episode. So wait, but here's an issue here. If you write a book, you don't celebrate when other authors write books, because that's going to take oxygen out of the room.
Is that right?
When you show up at Little Brown or Simon Schuster or wherever, Doubleday, you basically want to be the only one there.
Right. That's right.
It's a competitive world.
I think in the
Eric,
world,
I was talking.
Stop it.
Sorry, it's okay. A competitive world.
No, I was
world.
Talking before you come. But I think in the podcast world, it's like you used to interview someone. They used to have to show up at your door and they'd sit down and you'd talk, right? And now, I mean, now anyone, you know, you and I, you're, where are you in Copacabana?
I'm in Copacabana, yeah. I'm in Osterone.
And it doesn't matter where you are, you know, we could, well, I mean, I'm just stating obvious things.
Take a test, yeah. Sure, if you want.
Are you being testy?
test. So, yes. So it's a virtual kingdom. It's not clear to me if all these podcasts created COVID. Like, people say that COVID doesn't exist.
Right.
People probably think that dying doesn't exist either. Like, if you get sick and you die, that doesn't exist.
Correct.
People say all sorts of stuff. I mean, you can say whatever you want on a podcast, right? There's no fact checking here.
This is true. This is true. But I would find, you know what, I'll tell you, while we're just, you know, going off on podcasts, I think we were supposed to go off on something else, but that's the fun of a podcast. You do whatever damn thing you want.
Are we supposed to go off on something? Oh my God, I can't wait. It's exciting.
I promise we will go off on that thing.
We will get something, yeah.
But it is, you know, I'm amazed at these, like, you know, these discussions people have that go on for 3 hours. You know, I think that's amazing. You know, it kind of, you know, I don't want to say gone are the days, but... You know, we used to think that interviews were, you know, 6 minutes, you know, because that's all you could get on TV. It was like a 6-7 minute interview and maybe 20 minutes on Fresh Air, you know. But now you have interviews, like deep philosophical talks for 3+ hours, you know, or just deep information from like a, you know, I listened to this long distance runner on Lex Fridman, and then he talked to this guy on, you know, socialism or chess, you know, and so that's... That's kind of amazing.
The gates have been open. The gates have been open without any fact checking. I mean, the thing about discourse or that course or whatever course you're taking is that the gates have been open for streaming and infinite conversations and podcasts, and there's no fact checking. It's like people say stuff and there's no There's no, it's decentralized. People say whatever they want, and people believe half the stuff out there that's just not true.
Well, but I guess that's part of the deal, right? Is that people, because it's, you know, free and open, you're going to have people saying all sorts of things, but you also have a lot of, you know, very intellectual discussion with people checking each other and what they're saying. I think that all of that exists.
That's not true. World.
You don't think that's true? I thought I was going to get that one by you.
No way, man. I saw that one coming a mile off.
But so. It is also kind of amazing. I mean, I think maybe, you know, in the musical world, this is kind of then this leveling thing too, where, you know, anyone can get a microphone and record whatever they want, you know? And so, but like in this, you know, in the world where, you know, CNN used to control all of the interviews or whatever, I'm not trying to sound conspiratorial. It was just the truth. You had to get a camera and the big, you know, and now anyone can interview anyone and have, you know, all sorts of discussions. I think it's kind of amazing. I think it's more, there's more pros than cons, but, you know, you can prove me wrong.
It changes the whole landscape of the end user and the sound and the podcasts and videos and TV and everything, because what happens now, the gates have been open, and Rick Rubin was talking about this on his podcast.
Oh my God.
He was saying that the way people listen nowadays is, it used to be you would get your favorite musician, you know, Neil Young or whomever, and you would just stick to them and listen to them over and over in different ways. And now it's like, there's so many things coming at you from so many different angles. It's like, it's with the streaming world, you just, you know, you get a second of Neil Young and then, oh, there's Bob Dylan and then there's hip hop and there's this and this. And you just get a glimpse of one out of a million things zooming by.
Right, but you can dive into any of those. Is that what he was saying? Is it you can dive in, or
you can? Yeah. But for, I think what he was saying is the way people experience music now is,
oh, music wise,
music wise, it's just so much zooming by, and so if you hear a great song, like for instance, I was invited to an open mic in New Hampshire. They don't invite me in Vermont. Have to go the next date over. And I played a Steve Winwood song called Can't Find My Way Home. And I just adore that song. And it's just such a deep, and the way Steve Winwood, his voice is so amazing. But like, I really want to get into that song. But the reality is, I've got so many other songs that are zipping past me that it's sort of, it's hard to focus for me anyway.
Without a doubt. I mean, this is also, I guess this is also part of the age we're living in, is there's so much content, you know, so much content, you know. It used to be like, oh, this artist put out an album and that was like this big deal. And now there's such a tidal wave of content, you know, artists, you know, musicians on Spotify, Apple Music have very little voice because there's so much other content. It's like, oh, you want to, no, well, you don't want to be on our platform? Fine. but at the same time, it's kind of amazing because, you know, so many people can get on the platform. I guess it's, you know.
So you as a musician, how does this all affect you? I mean, is this a good thing that the gates have been open, or do you feel like it's hard for people to focus on your stuff?
Gosh, I have a lot of different heads about this. I mean, the word that comes into my mind most when I think about Spotify, which I use every day,
right?
But when I think about it as an artist, is gaslighting. That's the word that always comes into my head. That I read several years ago. I read about how Spotify is gaslighting all of us, and so it's like, I hate to say that, but that's the first word that comes to my, even though I use Spotify all the time. But as an artist, you know, there's the idea that somehow they're going to, you know, that I'm going to get any remuneration for my work through Spotify is a joke. I mean, they pretend, there's a bit of pretending, but I mean, even people that have done, you know, had big hits, you know, they'll get a check and it'll be like a check in the mail. It's like for, you know, $5.73. You know, some of the big artists, you know, will definitely, you know, like an album that's streaming, you know, say 10 million, you know, 20 million, 100 million. But right. I think most artists, you know,
they have a day job. Yeah.
Right. I could make an album tonight and put it up tomorrow. That's kind of amazing. So I don't know. I'm a few heads about it. So.
There's taking that concept of gaslighting. I remember in 2010, I was working on a project, which you were part of, called the Monkey Bible Project. That was sort of a show we were creating with the musical based on this second book I wrote. And I remember Facebook was becoming this great big thing, or maybe it was already a great big thing at that point. But I sort of bought into this gaslighting idea, like, wow, if I start taking out Facebook ads, and this is, I just bought right. into this whole mythology. Like, if a few friends tell a few other friends, and it's like compounded interest, if you're trying to invest and make money, except that's real. That's not so much gaslighting. This is fake mythology being spread by, I guess, maybe from the top down, from the big Z, Mark.
The big Z.
On down in the ideas. And I remember buying all these ads and trying to create a footprint along with like 80 million other idiots. And meanwhile, this guy's buying property and Lamborghinis right. or whatever right. the big Z does.
Right.
And it was a very interesting gaslighting sticky hook that I hooked my right. my dreams and my hopes and my ego to.
Right. Right.
Whoops.
I hear you, man.
Whoops. So speaking of which, there's another company that, I don't know, it's maybe not exactly the same thing. And maybe this is all leading up to the use of technology to spread excellence.
Mm.
But let's not get there yet. Let's get toward that, and let's take another step.
We're moving somewhere to that.
To that. So
by going backwards,
we're walking backwards, counting backwards to 34, not 16. And don't indict me over this, because it wasn't me. It was the butler.
With the candlestick?
It was a stormy night. anyway, so we went from Spotify to Facebook, and now let's move to Amazon. There's this guy named Big Jeff who runs that show, and I just recently had this crazy experience. It's sort of over the last few months where my first and second books have been selling for like 12 years up on Amazon. The first book is called Take Me for a Ride, Coming of Age in a Destructive Cult by Mark Lax. It's nonfiction. It's paperback. And I published it, Outer Rim Press, that's me, in 1993. And the second book is The Monkey Bible. That's a hardcover book also by me. So recently I've been doing my taxes, right? And I noticed there wasn't any revenue from my books. And usually I get, you know, I sell some books on Amazon. So I went up to Amazon.com and typed Mark Laxer, Take Me for a Ride. And drumroll, there's my book for sale with my name, my full name, and the contents of Take Me for a Ride, Coming of Age in a Destructive Cult. But it had a different cover and a different publisher. and a different year. It was in 2021.
Oh my God.
And that's called identity and content theft. Okay, that's not great news. This is all under the auspices of this this gaslighting, this promise of a digital heaven that we artists, you the musician, me the wannabe writer, can safely and happily inhabit. Ha, ha, ha. So I spent the next 3 months leading up to today. The journey continues. I've been doing this for months, trying to fix the problem in the house that Jeff B. built, and I can't do it.
So can I just interject for a second? You've researched this a lot more, obviously, but my guess is that like this is being done to hundreds of thousands of authors, where they're just, it's just they create a page for a book. They don't even print the book, but then people order it and somehow prints your book. I don't know. And then they get the money for it. Right. And then you get nothing out of it.
But I don't know who they is.
Correct. We don't know who they is, but this is somebody who's figured out this again to game the system. They just like can take advantage of all these authors who don't have a huge voice and try to call Amazon and you can't get through. And there's somebody who's figured out this kink in the system in Amazon that you can just basically steal everybody's intellectual property. That's what I'm guessing.
I think you're absolutely right. So what one does is one reaches out to Amazon and to send an email to their copyright department.
I bet the response is like, oh, we really care about what you have to say.
No,
this is
not
really
No. Here's what happened, Eric. So what happened was, so I send a nice little email. Hi, I've been a customer for, you know, I've been a seller, a vendor for over 10 years, and you get a good profit, and I get, you know, mm-hmm. I'm selling books, and the book helps people, and I got all these great reviews, and and this is what happened, this is my story. Bam, I send that off, and they say, please use our form.
Right.
So then I go to their form. And I started typing it in, but I can only type like, I don't know, like 100 characters or something. So I just give a little summary of my problem. And they say, so then I get an email response, and I can't respond to their email to me because it says no reply.
Oh, God.
So it says, please use our form.
Oh, God.
And so I use the form and says, hi, this is Mark again. And I tried to use your form, but it only has 100 characters or whatever, 200 characters. And I have a story I'm trying to tell you. Could I please speak with somebody? Anyway, months go by. I spend literally about 90 hours, plus or minus, incredibly frustrating. And I try, and basically they keep saying, use the form. And then finally, this is crazy. I'm like pulling my hair out. And I don't know, on an audio thing, you can't really see. I don't have that much hair left. So I need all the hair I can get. So as I count, I think I have 34 hairlets. Each one is an indictment on my hair loss. Anyway.
Use the form, Luke.
Use the form. So I finally said, screw it. I'm going to go outside the system. I'm going to go to their social media group. So I talk to the social media group and tell them what happened. They say, use the form. So then I thought, okay, I'm going to threaten to sue them. So I sent another email, and they said, why don't you reach out to our social media group? So I go back. I circle back to the social media group, and they say, why don't you call our customer service 800 number? They can help. So I call them, and they say, well, that's obvious. Let me just email you. And I say, I need to escalate. I need to talk to a manager. So they get a manager, and they say, don't worry. We got your back. We understand your problem. So they email me the solution. And I click on the link, and it takes me back to that original form.
Oh, Mark.
I'm in this Kafka-esque, Eric, you got to trust me. This is the gaslighting. This is the Kafka-esque, as a friend put it, Kafka-esque rabbit hole of insanity that technology built. And some people make billions and some people waste a lot of time because they don't have a system where you can actually speak with a human being who understands the problem, and they don't care.
Another book we're going to have to discuss one of these days is by Sebastian Younger. It's called Tribe, and I'm on my second reading of it. And he talks about like how, you know, CEOs, what they make, you know, versus like your regular person in the company or on the supply line, whatever. And how it's drastically gotten so much more over the years. And he sums it up. He's like, they make that much because they can.
Absolutely.
And no one can do it. And so the same thing here with Amazon. They do it because they can.
Right. And let us hear in our podcast, Take Me for a Ride podcast, Eric Mehring, Mark Laxer, let's say it here first. Let's come up with an idea that will become a meme and spread throughout reality. And that is, there needs to be a system whereby we have a choice as customers. Like, I'm not going to buy it from your company unless you have phone support.
Right.
Oh, you don't have phone support? Sorry, not going to buy it. So I'm just putting it out there. Universe, listen to this idea. Thank you.
Weren't we going to turn, we went back and then now we're going forward to like something like, I guess like some super positive in terms of, you know, technological advancement.
So we went from Spotify to Facebook to Amazon and the Amazon hell world. But there is a brighter side to technology where art and technology and culture and counterculture and excellence have their confluence where they join. And this, I'm thinking about Steve Jobs and the story of his life and Apple, which is a whole different take on the digital revolution.
So you and I just read his biography by author
Walter Isaacson.
Now, I guess you've read it now like a number of times.
This is the fourth time.
Wow. And I guess it's just lucky. This is it kind of kickstarted our getting back to the podcast, which we've talked about for a while. And that showed up in Libby, you know, and I was like, oh, let me read that book. And then I was kind of thinking of you, and then you're like, oh, awesome. So, and that was, I'm glad that's kind of got us, you know, aligned with reading the same book, which has been a big part of this podcast. And so it was a real fun, interesting, inspiring read. Made me think a lot.
What was your take on Steve's life? Like, what were you inspired by? What bothered you? Or,
well, I mean, gosh, many things. I thought what was really interesting is, you know, like you, I lived through all this, all these devices. You know, I remember the Apple. I remember the Apple IIe computer. My family got it, and it was like, whoa. And that thing, at that time, that was, I don't know what year that was, 82 or something. I'm going to get the date wrong, but that thing cost $3,000 at that time. That's what I remember. But, you know, so it was really neat to be, like, reading about the progression of all these devices and, you know, the iPod. Did you ever have an iPod in the 2000s?
Mm.
I mean, that was amazing. I loved the iPod with the wheel and all that.
Wheel,
yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. That was amazing, and we loved that thing. It was like, and I was amazed to know that like those folks at Apple loved the devices too. I mean, they made them because they wanted to enjoy them as well. It's not like they were just trying to sell us content. They wanted to make something you know, badass. And anyway, there's many things to say, but it was neat to have gone through a bunch of these devices and then reading about the development of each of them.
I think we can sort of draw a contrast with the other things we've just been talking about, the other large entities. And Apple seems to have, or at least certainly the story of Steve Jobs is, certainly cared about money, because without money you can't really do a whole lot. But his drive, his main focus, as described in this book, was to create excellent products. That was his passion. Right. And that's what he cared about that so much. And he was really into design. He was a perfectionist. He's sort of like the Stanley Kubrick of product design. And
really took it seriously, really cared about the edges and the feel and
everything, every detail and the fonts and
the fonts. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Oh,
to the point of some people might say he'd gone overboard, but he was so passionate about that. And I think about some of these other companies that just don't give a hoot about vast elements of the user experience. They just don't care. I mean, what is Amazon? Amazon was built on the back of small time authors. They started selling books. Am I not correct? And then they expanded.
They did. That was their first thing.
Yeah. Right. And look how they treat the authors. Look how they treat them. And it just seems like there's a different culture that was created when Apple came into being. It was just a different DNA of in the hearts and the souls. And I think that's why Apple to this day is super special.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I must mention the reality distortion field, which they spoke of about Steve Jobs a lot. That touched me. I thought that was pretty wild. I mean, it probably sucked at times to be in his. You know, he was an intense guy. You know, he could really. He could, you know, level people because he was so intense. But his reality distortion field, which they talked about, was just to be like, oh, we have to have it by, you know, next Wednesday. And people are like, there's no way we can do that. And he would just be like, yeah, we're going to do it. It's going to happen. And like how many things he accomplished using that kind of technique, you know. You know, and I identify with that a little bit. I mean, I sometimes, and I know you do too, you know, we have these kind of, it can be a little intense when it comes to like accomplishing things or having groups or doing things. And sometimes people are like, whoa, you know, whoa. But it also, you know, the results, that man got results, you know?
I think about that, Eric, because that kind of charisma, which is what I think we're talking about, can have a really rough edge. And I was thinking of, because I have a software company, I'm thinking like the parallel with Apple. You need like sweet, nice guys like Steve Wozniak who helped found Apple,
Right, who wanted to give away the software, right?
Give it away for free,
right? Right.
Yeah. Why? If it costs $50 to make, why not sell it for $50? That's like Steve Wozniak's approach. He didn't see hierarchy the way that Jobs did. But it's great to have a bunch of nice people who are super smart. They're easy to work with, and they're flexible, and they're kind, and they're considerate. But that doesn't necessarily a great project make, because it's a rough competitive world out there. And to cut through, like, for instance, if I were Steve Jobs, I'm sure I could have cut through this Amazon crap that I've been going through. I tried to be mean and tough, but I'm not that great at that. Sometimes I practice, but I, like in my software company, I founded it, and then I brought in somebody who was tougher than me, and he was the hammer. And I needed that. So
right.
He could just, the guy I brought in, this wonderful, wonderful, he also has a big heart, just like Steve Jobs has a big heart. But he could be tough. Like, he could fire right. people. I can't fire people.
Right,
I can
right,
never
right,
do
right.
that. If someone was, like, if it's up to me and I'm working with someone who's sort of meh, they're not doing a great job. I'm doing a film project right now, and it took me a long time to clean up my team.
You know what? Yeah, sorry, I thought of projects we've done. When they were talking about A-game, isn't that the word that they use, like A-game?
A-game. You're on the A-team,
He had like these just like A-game people, and that's all he wanted was like, and that to help, you know, he used, what was the B-game or B, I can't remember, B-team kind of thing, and it would just, people that would, you know, give excuses or would show up late or da-da-da-da and all that stuff. And I really identify with that, you know. I'm like very much, you know, I like that A-game kind of mentality. I really do.
Right.
My music classes start always on time. Always. Parents, you know, you better realize we are starting on time every time. And it's never, oh, you're not here. That's okay. It's still starting at 9:30. That's when the class starts. You know, I think there's some to that. And I think all that kind of approach to things, you know, it has something to do with why we love our iPhones and stuff. It's not like, oh, whatever, or whoever, or do whatever you like. I mean, that's the other thing, is he was a part of that energy. He came up in San Francisco. He came up in the, you know, the hippie kind of, you know, whatever, 70s kind of, you know, energy. And that was certainly a part of him, but there was also a kind of, I don't want to say militant, but a very, you know, a very intense accomplishment kind of bar. And that, you don't get that from just doing whatever you want.
Right. It was exactly, for Steve, it was extremely focused. There was enormous discipline and no bullshit. Like, and I think he went overboard, and I think sometimes he would admit it, in being mean to people. He didn't have to be mean. And yet that seemed to work wonders in terms of motivating people, because you could be intense, but if you're still a sweetie, a softie, people are going to respond to that. And someone like myself needs to partner with someone who's got a tougher exterior, because that's not me. I can't do that. It's really difficult for me to do that. Whereas the business partner I pulled in my company, it was quite natural for him to throw his weight around, but right. in an effective, he was a good person. He is a good person.
Right.
A very close friend of mine, right. A family friend. And I have a huge amount of respect for him, but he could do things I could never do. And right. Steve Jobs seemed to be such a paradox, which I think you were just saying, Eric, in that he did grow up out of the counterculture movement. He'd show up to work barefoot and not showering and meditating
right.
and
right.
eating fruitarian, crazy vegan, you know, he's like crazy hippie LSD stuff. So, but that comes with a certain, for sure, like, oh my God, like, that's so groovy.
You know,
but that wasn't him. He had other sides that were entrepreneurial and capitalistic and hugely competitive. So he was many different things in one body.
On the fruit and the reality distortion field, I mean, I think that though that did benefit him so much, it also may have had to do with his early death. You know, it sounds like in the book he found out about a cancer. I may get this slightly wrong, so forgive me, but that he found out about his cancer and he didn't treat it for like 6 months or something.
It was kind like of hope that 8 or 9 months, yeah. Something
hope that
like
if
that.
He ate, you know, ate really well and took care of himself, and then what did it do? It spread. And I think that was like where the reality distortion field, he wasn't able to, you know, control it.
It worked on other people's psyches, not on his own. biological body.
Right. Right. I did watch his funeral, you know, after I didn't tune into that when he passed away. But I, on YouTube, obviously you can watch anything. I was watching his funeral. It was really moving. I was like, man, this guy was really worshiped. Holy moly. Seeing the musicians, Norah Jones singing at his funeral and stuff. That was pretty moving. So
I was really moved by the book once again, and was crying at the end. And there's something about him that I can relate to. I also grew up in the sort of at the end of the, well, he was older than me, but the whole hippie movement and the counterculture and the Whole Earth Catalog. I was and Be Here Now and the Autobiography of a Yogi and meditation stuff. I was very much part of that and very much into the tech and design.
I know you were. Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of his life, I'm not Steve Jobs. I'm certainly not as bright or as driven as him, although I am quite driven, but nowhere near his.
You're part of that, but you're part of that culture. Definitely.
I have some of his threads. So
you do,
And it sort of raises a question because this does not happen with me, with my projects. And maybe this comes back to Rick Rubin and his amazing abilities as a music producer, just as Steve Jobs had this insane successes in so many different fields, whether it's product design or App Store or iCloud ideas and Apple itself. I mean, Pixar, everything he touched became insanely successful. And I think the same with the music producer. It sort of raises a question, like, how do we get there? What can we learn? And the same for anyone listening to this podcast. I'm now paying people $1 to listen to each 5 minutes. It's expensive, but I want an audience. But how can we get to a level of success, however we define success? And it's not so easy. You could say, well, you need to be in the right place at the right time. I think Rick was saying, Ruben, that you just need to listen, quiet yourself and listen and trust yourself. Well, the thing is, Eric, I do quiet my mind. I do trust myself. I do listen, and I create art, whether that's a book or I'm making a film or whatever I'm doing, and it's sort of in very small circles. So
yeah, join the hordes.
Yeah. So how do you break out? I think one thing that's helpful is you're in the right place at the right time. Another is that you have this amazing ability to see and feel what other people want. You sort of see the future, and you can create it. And you have a soft side, a vulnerable side, and a tough exterior to make stuff happen.
Right.
And you need connections too. Like Steve Jobs would pick up the phone and like the guy running Hewlett Packard, the founder, would pick up the phone and say, how can I help you? He was bold, but I'm also bold. He was bold. And again, he's charismatic. He's better looking. He's this, he's that, you know, he's also a genius that I'm not, but it helps to have, if I don't know, it's just connections of, you know, like, someone from the media. Like I tried for a full year, full time, to try to reach someone in the media, big media, little media, any type of media, for my third book, Rama Trauma Trump. I left the cult and now it happened. A free graphic novel that was made into an animated video. I couldn't get a single bite. And he just like scratches his nose and Steve Jobs, he's got a whole you know, plethora of media people swarming every word he says. There's good reasons for that. I'm not trying to say that I should be Steve Jobs, but I'm just saying that you sort of need some lucky break to break into media.
Yeah, yes. I mean, he also created devices that were, you know, everyone, you know, between like anyone's book and these iPhones in our hands, is like you would take that iPhone like any day over anything that anyone else could offer you, you know, in terms of like, I don't know. Yeah, he created something that can fit, you know, 10,000. Don't even need to fit them in here, you know. I mean, I think that's what was his, you know, he did nail it at a certain time. There's no doubt he was born and grew up. It's crazy to read about his birth and his, you know, his adoption and all that. I didn't know anything about that. But, you know, he came up, he brought something to the world that no one had brought before. And, I mean, the iPad is crazy, you know, all of these things. It's just, it's nuts. It's nuts. I mean, as a musician, the iPad for me is just like all of my books now as a musician, all that my music, it's all in there. And it's just such a, what a tool, you know. It's not just a content. It's also a tool. It's also all of these things all in one.
He would see different parts of technology and interface, and it's almost like a type of storytelling, a way to interact with a device. And he would go like walk around Xerox Park or something and see the new GUI that they were developing, and they weren't really using it much. And he's like,
correct.
Oh, I got this idea. And they could have run with it. Sony could have run with making an iPod type of thing. And it was Steve's genius to put A together with B together with C.
Correct.
And also, you know, and then he was able to reach out to people through these amazing advertising campaigns where he's really emotionally connecting people with our devices are for those who walk a different path, a very romantic way to put it. We want to push back against IBM because they're like Big Brother. For those people who have the good fortune to have read George Orwell's 1984, he would cast the other company as like Big Brother, and he's like, think differently. We're the rebels. We're the movers. We're the creative. It turns out, behind the scenes, he was more like Big Brother. He was like the most controlling, manipulative technocrat out there, much more than Bill Gates or IBM. But the image that he put out there, which is to this day is so enticing, is I want to be different. I want to be colorful. I want to be colorful and I want to dance in the world of creativity. And he put that image out there and people bought it and bought into it.
I do, you know, just to kind of play the other side, this book did make me ask questions of like the bigger, like philosophical questions, like what is all this for? You know, like why? I mean, this is not just Steve Jobs, but it is like he did create devices that like so many people, everyone in the world wants. My son's included, you know, who they look at these devices all the time. And like, what is this for? You know, because, you know, reading a book has become a lot harder now that these devices are in our hands and these iPads are in our faces and these computers. And this is a bigger question. We actually discussed this the internet with Erica and Leo a while back on this podcast, our kids. But like, are these, what is the, I don't know, there's a bigger philosophical question, an environmental question in me that I was asking. Like, as much of a hero as Steve Jobs is, it's also like, where are we going with all this? Like maybe there's like this secret that none of us know, that this is supposed to be going toward this direction where there's going to be this, I don't know, but like I did kind of have to step back also and ask, so what are all these devices for? Even though I get it, yes, they're amazing and the connection, and here you and I are talking in different states and all these things. But in the big picture, I'd say, and I had that question. I had to step back and say, and what was motivating Steve Jobs, like beyond what he could understand, you know, does this have like a good ending?
Do you want the positive ending or the sort of the slightly pejorative ending, Eric? Or if you want both, which one do you want first?
I want the one that has, like, if you've ever, like, put sliced peaches and put them on a grill.
Yes.
Have you ever done that?
Yes, this morning. I'm talking about the morning that hasn't happened yet. I've already done that.
The sadness, you mean, that kind of morning?
Correct, yes. It's so broken. Peaches, morning
did they burn
broken.
When you put them on the...
So, let me give an aesthetic, artistic response to your highly technical... spiritual question. Ready?
Yes.
Bum 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 bum. I'm of course referring to the movie. I'm singing the soundtrack of 2001: A Space Odyssey, directed by Stanley Kubrick. Well, this is an amazing movie that came out, I believe, in the 60s. That essentially was about artificial intelligence. And one possible response to your question is, where is this all going? Well, with these devices and the ubiquitousness of cell phones and digital helpers, if you will.
Right.
It seems that disinformation is so... That's what comes back to my point about fact-checking, because I joke about that, but I'm actually quite... Behind the joking, I'm actually quite serious about it. With such a decentralized way of communicating through social media and everyone's got their narrative up there with no fact-checking... it seems to me that where we're going is a very dark place politically and in terms of these chat bots and artificial intelligence. It just seems that our species is designed to be gaslit. We are a hierarchical species that looks to... the alpha for our information. It's not ingrained in us to push back and say, oh yeah, prove it. Although in Missouri they do that, but not the rest of the country. So I think these technologies free some people up, but there's a larger movement toward darkness. And in the movie 2001 Space Odyssey, there's a computer called HAL that sort of, I don't want to give away the ending. I suggest everyone sees this movie from the 60s. It's just the most brilliant movie. But the computer pushes back against the humans, and it's a bit scary. And that's where I feel like we're going.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, I'm in the end.
Awesome, brother. I'm grateful that we can just get on here and sing together.
That's profound. I performed that the other weekend in New Hampshire in front of 30 people by first telling a story about how I traveled with my two kids for 11 days in northern Norway with my two kids and my ex-wife, and how profound a journey that was to be able to make that happen. I was actually very proud of myself, and I sort of had to be, I had to change, sort of in the song, he's talking about, somebody must change. And I really relate to that, because to make that trip over the years, I had to become someone else. And when I was up in northern Norway, with my family, I was thinking that this is a profound experience and I'm somewhere else and I can't find my way home. I'm somewhere else and I'm completely different. And it felt alien and sad and very beautiful.
They called him Mr. Peach, which was already trademarked, and but he bought it on Amazon.
He tried to return the peach on Amazon, and he got customer service, and they said, the peach you have reached, you have reached a peach. And although he's twice been impeached, he has 34 counts of hair.
One, two...
Hair.
Three.
Hair today... Goon tomorrow.
Shave tomorrow.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
What do you think about all that with the shaving, you know, the head, like, what's his name? The guy on Amazon? What's his head? What's his name?
What's his head?
What is his name?
Bezos.
Bezos. Like Bezos, like kisses. Because
it's like Bozo.
Love to kiss his... No, it's not like Bozo.
Bezos the clown.
Bezos, like kisses for his head because he shaves his head. Don't you understand? Like Mr. Peach, like admired Bezos for his head because it looked so much like a peach. So they would often, like, you know, they'd often like sell his head. Actually, if you go on Amazon, you can buy Jeff Bezos's head.
No. That's simply not the case. For it's the way Amazon has it set up is you can actually subscribe to their slime program, Amazon Slime.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, for 99 something. And what you do is for every 100 hours, once you're in that program,
yeah,
for every 100 hours that you waste dealing with their customer service, you get to kiss Jeff Bezos's head once.
I see a lot of smooches on that head. Smooches for pooches.
Well, it's actually a trade for Gucci. Gooch for pooch for a smooch.
Gucci.
Uchi.
Uchi. Yeah. Gucci Bucci.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway. It, I mean,
and then when you talk to Jeff, you say, is that audible? Because you can't hear the smooch. Exactly. So you don't know if it's audible or if it's plime or slime. Or grime.
Plime?
Yeah.
Plime.
I don't mean to say anything bad about Amazon.com. I'm talking about the jungle when I say Amazon.
Fucking jungle.
Damn jungle. It's a bunch of gaslighting people. Peaches trying to take care of their, have their osterones that they're testing.
Ostrich.
Yes.
Wasn't there an ostrich that one time when, what was his name? Rudy Giuliani. You remember that guy?
Is like, that the it guy was like who 30 years. Egg them on?
Eggs Benedict.
Yeah. It's an ostrich egg.
He had like 34 hairs on his chin and he was down in the Amazon rowing in that big canoe. Do you remember that? And there was like peaches in the front. Do you remember that?
It was peaches in the front, but I think Rudy is sort of a perfect example of what happens when too many people at one time start smoking marijuana.
Is too many people as in two?
T- too many people. Exactly. Yeah.
And that creates what? Slime?
No, it creates a sort of a field of disinformation.
Disinformation, the reality distortion slime.
Oh, miss.
Oh, miss, it's time to put on the Ritz, as in the Ritz-Carlton, which is where, once upon a time, Steve Jobs met Rudy Giuliani. And together, they roasted peaches, and one of them went off to be worshipped at his funeral, and the other went off to hit on Borat's daughter.
So if you had a choice, Eric, of being Rick Rubin, Steve mm-hmm. Jobs,
ooh,
or Donald Trump, or Rudy Giuliani, ooh, or Sacha ooh. Baron Cohen,
ooh,
or Eric Mehring.
Oh, okay. Well, you include me. I mean, honestly, if I could be any of those people,
right,
while we're playing this, I would say Rick Rubin.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I would be Steve Jobs any day.
You would be Steve Jobs.
Oh my God.
I mean, Rick Rubin, just hearing that guy talk about all his, you know, all the people he's gotten to interact with, and, you know, because I'm, you know, a musician. So it's like, whoa, that guy's a badass. That guy's a guru. But yeah, you be Steve Jobs. I'll be Rick Rubin. Together, we'll start our new company, which is called
Have a Nice Bidet. And it's run by assholes. See, that if you were to say, okay, Mr. Peach, what is the one thread that goes through everything we've discussed so far? It has to do with some people are assholes and we need to clean that up. And that's where the bidet comes in. Have a nice bidet.
Have a nice bidet.
And if you know, Eric, if you think about it, how much toilet paper? Look, I'm thinking about the crap that Amazon puts out.
Right.
And Steve Jobs sometimes was an asshole. He said it. He said that he was acting like an asshole. He was aware of it, and yet he continued to do it. The 34
asshole
indictments, clearly someone's being an asshole. So we see this thread that is being wound all around us. And what I'm suggesting here, right here, is that if you think about how much wood and paper is wasted through toilet paper, and how much mm-hmm. and how much cleaner and more hygienic the world would be if people, there's no electricity needed, people just bought bidets and just had a nice bidet.
I'm totally with you.
Just enough of this crap, Eric.
How about everyone gets a bidet, a bidet and a Monet? You can have a Monet while you use your bidet.
Yeah, and there was that actress Doris Day?
Yeah, exactly. I think Monet, didn't he paint Doris Day on his bidet?
No, that was a film. It wasn't a play. And I was just saying to her, don't leave, stay. But
hey.
Anyway, I found this company. It's called Tushy. I swear to God. I just ordered two of them for it just seems to me on a societal level, we need to clean ourselves up a bit in an efficient
wipe
a clean slate. Then you know what I mean. Oh dear. I just feel like it's our duty to get this right.
Oh say can you see.
Hello, Mr. Peach? Is that you?
The dawn's early.
Steve? Are you back among us?
What so proudly we...
Are you thinking differently? Are you...
At the...
Is this the counter or the counterculture?
blast. Glee.
Hal, open the pod bay door.
Who's brought and pair?
Is this artificial intelligence or artificial insemination? Open the pod bay door, Hal.
Bursting.
Daisy.
Through the
daisy.
That I give was me still
your true.
That star
spangled crazy.
So
if we were to summarize, Eric, what we really need is not artificial intelligence, we need actual intelligence.
Yes. For the land of the free and the home of the
indictment.